Do you know your place? Don't you know who I am?
Pino felt like he'd been slapped at the back of the head.
Oui, mon général. Then you will keep your mouth shut. You will not ask questions of me or anyone else, and you will do as you are told. Do you understand?
Oui, mon général, Pino said, shaken.
I am sorry, mon général. When they reached Dolly's apartment building, Liar said he'd take the valise up himself and ordered Pino to return the Fiat to the motor pool. Pino wanted to follow the general upstairs or go around the back and get Anna to let him in, but it was still daylight and he feared he'd get caught. After a long look at the windows of Dolly's apartment, he drove away, thinking how much he wanted to tell Anna about all that he'd seen that day. The violence, the violation, the despair. That night, and for many nights afterward, Pino's dreams were haunted by the red train and Platform 21. He kept hearing the woman beg him to pray for her. He kept seeing those poor little fingers wiggling at him, and dreamed that they belonged to a child of a thousand faces, a child who could not be saved. Over the ensuing weeks and days, Pino drove General Liars all over northern Italy. They rarely slept. At the wheel, Pino often wondered about the faceless child and the woman he'd spoken to on Platform 21. Had they gone to Poland to be worked to death? Or had the Nazis just taken them somewhere and machine-gunned them the way they had in Mena and a dozen other desecrated places throughout Italy? When he wasn't driving, Pino felt powerless and exhausted, watching Liars loot factories for machine tools and seize a staggering quantity of building supplies, vehicles, and food. Entire towns were stripped of basic commodities, which were either shipped to Germany by train or distributed to soldiers on the Gothic line. Through it all, Liars remained stoic, pitiless, and committed to his task.
I keep telling you the Allies need to be bombing the train tracks over the Brenner Pass, Pino told his uncle one night in late October 1944. They need to cut it off, or there will be no food left for any of us, and winter's coming.
I've had Baca send that message twice, Uncle Albert said in frustration. But the world's focused on France and forgotten Italy.
3. On Friday, October 27th, 1944, Pino again drove General Liars to Benito Mussolini's villa at Garignano. It was a warm fall day. The leaves of hardwood trees had turned fiery far up into the Alps. The sky was a crystalline blue, and the surface of Lake Garda mirrored both, causing Pino to wonder whether there was a more beautiful place in the world than northern Italy. He followed Liars up onto the villa's colonnade and to the terrace, which was empty and strewn with leaves. The French doors to Mussolini's office were thrown open, however, and they found Il Duce inside, standing at his desk, the suspenders of his riding pants hanging by his sides and his tunic well undone. The dictator had a phone pressed to his ear, and his face was twisted into something spiteful.
Claretta, Rachele's gone crazy, Il Duce was saying. She's coming for you. Don't talk to her. She says she's going to kill you, so close the gate and... Okay. Okay, call me back.
Mussolini hung up the phone, shaking his head, before noticing General Liars and Pino standing there. He said,
Ask the general if his wife is insane over Dolly.
Pino did. Liars looked surprised that Il Duce knew about his mistress, but said,
My wife is insane over most things, but she knows nothing of Dolly.
How can I be of service, Duce?
Why does Field Marshal Kesselring always send you to see me, General Liars?
He trusts me. You trust me.
Do I?
Have I ever done anything to make you question my honor?
Mussolini poured himself some wine and then shook his head.
General, why doesn't Kesselring trust my army enough to use it? I have so many loyal, well-trained men, true fascists, willing to fight for Salo, and yet they sit in their barracks.
It doesn't make sense to me either, Duce, but the Field Marshal has a far greater military mind than mine. I am but an engineer.
The phone rang. Mussolini grabbed it, listened, and said,
Rachele?
The dictator pulled his head off the receiver, wincing while his wife's voice came screaming out into the room with remarkable clarity.
The partisans! They're sending me poems, Benito! One line says over and over again, we will take you all to Piazzale Loreto. They blame me, they blame you, and they blame your bitch of a mistress. For that, she's going to die.
The dictator smashed the phone down in its cradle, looking shaken, and then stared at Pino for an indication of how much he'd heard. Pino swallowed and became fascinated by the stitchwork in the rug.
Liars said, Duce, I have a busy schedule.
Preparing your retreat? Mussolini sneered. Your run toward the Brenner Pass?
The Gothic line still holds.
I hear it has holes in it, Il Duce said, and drained his wine. Tell me, General, is it true that Hitler is building a last redoubt? Somewhere underground in the German Alps, where he will retreat with his most loyal followers?
One hears many such stories, but I have no direct knowledge of that one.
If there is, will there be a place in that underground fortress for me?
I can't speak for the Führer, Duce.
That's not what I hear, Mussolini said. But at the very least, maybe you can speak for Albert Speer. Surely Hitler's architect would know if there was such a place.
I'll ask the Reich Minister the next time we speak, Duce.
I'll need a room for two, the dictator said, and poured himself more wine.
Duly noted, the general said.
And now I must leave. I have a meeting in Turin.
Mussolini looked ready to argue, but the phone rang. He winced, picked it up. Liars turned to go. As Pino started to follow, he heard Mussolini say,
Claretta, did you shut the gate?
There was a pause before Il Duce roared,
Rachele's there? Get your guard to get her off the gate before she hurts herself!
They heard more shouting as they walked off the terrace and down the stairs. Back in the Fiat, General Liars shook his head and said,
Why do I always feel like I have been to a madhouse when I leave this place?
Il Duce says many strange things, Pino said.
How he led a country is beyond me, Liars said. But they say the train system ran like German clockwork when he was in full power.
Is there an underground fortress in the Alps? Pino asked.
Only a lunatic would believe in something like that.
Pino wanted to remind the general that Adolf Hitler wasn't exactly stable, but he thought better of it, and they drove on.
4.
Shortly after sunset, on Tuesday, October 31st, 1944, General Liars told Pino to drive him to the train station in the city of Monza, about 15 kilometers northeast of Milan. Pino was exhausted. They'd been on the road almost constantly, and he wanted to sleep and to see Anna. They'd barely had 10 minutes together since the night of the strafing. But Pino followed orders and turned the Fiat north. The second full moon of the month, the true blue moon, rose, casting a pale light that made the countryside look like dark turquoise. When they reached the Monza station and the general climbed out, Organization Tote sentries locked at attention. They were Italians, young men like Pino, trying to survive the war.
"Tell them I'm here to oversee a transfer in the yard," General Lyers said.
Pino did, and they nodded and gestured to the far end of the platform. A small lorry pulled up. Two OT soldiers and four men in shabby gray clothes got out. They had patches on their chests. Three said OST. The fourth said P.
"Wait here, Vorarbeiter,"
General Lyers told Pino in a cordial tone.
"I won't be long, no more than an hour, and then we can get that well-needed sleep and see our lady friends, okay?"
Feeling punchy, Pino smiled and nodded. He wanted to lie down on one of the benches and go to sleep right then. But watching Lyers take a flashlight from one of the soldiers and lead the way toward the far end of the platform, he came alert. The general didn't have the valise with him. It was in the Fiat, out in front of the station. An hour, no more, Lyers had said. But that was plenty enough time to go through the valise, wasn't it? Uncle Albert had never gotten him the camera he said he'd look into. But Pino had the general's camera, loaded with what he knew to be a fresh roll of film. Lyers insisted on keeping the camera in the car so he could take pictures of sites for possible artillery installations. And when the general did take pictures, he always removed the film and replaced it with a new roll, even if it wasn't full. Pino decided that if he came across something that looked important, he'd photograph the papers, take the film, and replace it with another fresh roll from the glove compartment. He'd taken two steps toward the Fiat when something beyond fatigue bothered him. Something about the way Lyers had walked off just then, leading the four slaves and the two OT soldiers. He couldn't put his finger on it, but he wondered what Lyers might be transferring by the light of the full moon. And why didn't the general want him to see the transfer? That was odd. Where Lyers went, Pino usually went as well. A train whistled not far away. Torn in two directions, Pino went with his gut and padded off toward the end of the platform where Lyers had disappeared. By the time he'd jumped down into the yard and walked well away from the station without seeing the general or the others with him, a freight train came rumbling into the station and squealed to a stop. Pino scrambled under one of the train's boxcars and crawled over the tracks. When he reached the other side, he heard voices. Peering out from under the train and to his right, he saw the two OT soldiers silhouetted by the general's flashlight. They were coming Pino's way. Pino pressed himself tight to the wheels of the boxcar and watched the soldiers go by. He looked out and to his right again and made out Lyers standing with his back to him about 60 meters away. The general was watching the four gray men. They had formed a line and were moving objects from a boxcar that was part of the freight train to a lone boxcar on the adjacent track. The objects weren't very big, but the slaves had to put their entire bodies into holding and moving the heavy loads. If Pino couldn't tell his uncle what he'd seen in Lyers's valise, he at least wanted to be able to tell him what the general was transferring after dark and why he was personally overseeing the slaves doing the work. After scrambling back to the other side of the freight train, Pino tried to be as light on his feet as possible and moved forward with the boxcars between him and Lyers, thankful to hear the clunking of heavy metal objects the closer he got. Thunk, thunk, clunk. He caught the rhythm of the timing and moved with it, one foot to the other, until he felt he'd drawn even with the group, and then one knee and hand to the other as he crawled under the freight train. He peeked out the other side to find himself fewer than 10 meters from the general. Lyers had the flashlight aimed at the cinders between the rails, so the men worked in the glow of a light at their feet. Pino could see one man in the boxcar above Lyers handing out narrow rectangular objects that he couldn't quite make out, as they were passed above the waist from one man to another and into the opposite boxcar, which was a rusty orange color. What the hell was... The third man in line fumbled and almost dropped one. Lyers shifted the flashlight beam, shone it on the object in the man's hands, and Pino had to fight not to gasp. It was a brick. A brick made of gold.
Das ist genug, Lyers said, telling them in German. That's enough.
The four slave laborers looked at the general expectantly. He waved with the flashlight toward the boxcars, indicating they should shut and lock them. Pino realized the gold transfer was complete, which meant Lyers would soon be heading toward the station and the Fiat. He crabbed backward slowly, and then quicker, when he heard the door to the boxcar above him sliding shut. He was back on his feet on the other side of the train when the second boxcar door shut. Pino danced away on his tiptoes and to the side of the cinders where the weeds grew and muffled the sound of his passing. Within a minute, he was clambering up onto the train platform. The freight train's locomotive grumbled at the far end of the track. The wheels creaked, whined, and gained speed. The couplings between the cars ground. And every rail tie crossed made a solid, steady thump, thump, thump. And Pino heard the flat crack of gunshots clearly. The first one he doubted, but not the second, third, or fourth, which were spaced at intervals of 2 to 4 seconds, and coming from Lyris's direction. It was all over in less than 15 seconds. The two OT soldiers whom Lyers had ordered away from the transfer site came out onto the platform, as if they too had heard the shots. With horror and growing anger, Pino thought, 4 slaves dead. 4 witnesses to a gold diversion dead. Lyers had pulled the trigger. He'd cold-bloodedly executed them. And he'd planned to do it long before tonight. The last of the freight train boxcars passed the platform and thumped off into the night, carrying a fortune in what Pino assumed was looted gold. There was a fortune out there in the train yard, too. How much gold had there been? Enough to kill 4 innocent men, Pino thought. Enough to... He heard the crunch of General Lyers's boots before he saw him as a shade of darkness out there in the moonlit night. Lyers flipped on the flashlight, played it on the platform, and found Pino, who raised his forearm to block the beam and had the quick, panicked thought that the general may have decided to kill him, too.
"There you are, Vorarbeiter," General Lyers said. "Did you hear those shots?"
Pino decided dumb was his best strategy.
"Shots, mon général?"
Lyers came to the platform, shaking his head in bemusement.
4 of them. All clean misses. I've never been able to shoot worth a damn."
"Mon général? I don't understand."
"I was transferring something important to Italy out there, protecting it," he said. "And when I had my back turned, the 4 laborers took their chance and ran for it."
Pino frowned.
"And you shot them?"
"I shot at them," General Lyers said. "Or rather, over them and behind them. I'm a horrible marksman. I didn't care, really. I don't care. Good luck to them."
Lyers clapped his hands.
"Take me to Dolly's, Vorarbeiter. It's been a long day."
If General Lyers was lying, if he'd killed the 4 slaves, he was also a superb actor, or someone who had no conscience, Pino thought, as he drove back to Milan. Then again, Lyers had been shaken by the Jews of Platform 21.
Maybe he had a conscience when it came to certain things, and not to others. The general seemed in a happy enough mood during the ride, chuckling to himself, or smacking his lips with satisfaction every once in a while. And why not? He'd just stashed away a fortune in gold. The general said he'd done it for Italy, protecting it. But as Pino pulled the Fiat up in front of Dolly's, he remained skeptical. Why would Liars protect anything for Italy, after he'd stolen so much from the country already? And Pino had heard enough stories in life to know that men acted strangely, irrationally, when gold was involved. When they reached the apartment on the Via Dante, General Liars climbed out of the car with the valise in his hand.
"You have the day off tomorrow, Vorarbeiter," Liars said.
"Thank you, mon général," Pino said, bobbing his head. Pino needed a day off. He also needed to see Anna, but he was obviously not being invited to go upstairs for a glass of whiskey. The general made a move toward the front door, but then stopped.
"You may use the car tomorrow, Vorarbeiter," he said. "Take the maid anywhere you want to go. Enjoy yourselves."
5. The next morning, Anna came down the stairs to the lobby just as Pino was coming through the front door. They both nodded uncertainly to the crone blinking on the stool, and then left, laughing and happy to be in each other's company.
"This is nice," she said, taking the passenger seat next to him.
Pino felt good to be out of his OT uniform. He was someone completely different. So was Anna. She wore a blue dress, black pumps, and a fine wool shawl around her shoulders. She'd put on lipstick and mascara and...
"What?" she said.
"You're just so beautiful, Anna. You make me want to sing."
"You're so sweet," she said. "And I'd kiss you if I didn't want to smear Dolly's expensive French lipstick."
"Where shall we go?"
"Somewhere pretty. Somewhere we can forget the war."
Pino thought about that and said, "I know just the place."
"But before I forget," Anna said, reaching in her purse and handing him an envelope. "General Liars says it's a letter of passage under his signature."
It was astonishing how attitudes changed when Pino showed the letter to sentries along the route to Chernobyl. Pino drove Anna to his favorite spot on Lake Como, a small park near the southern end of the lake's west arm. It was a clear, unusually warm, breezy autumn day. The sky was a thin blue, and snow dusted the tallest crags, the mountains and their reflection in the lake like two joined watercolor paintings. Pino felt hot and took off his heavy shirt, revealing a sleeveless white t-shirt.
"It's so beautiful," Anna said. "I see why you love it here."
"I've stood here 1,000 times, and it still doesn't look real to me. Like it's God's vision, nothing human about it, you know?"
"I do."
"Let me take a picture of you here," Anna said, pulling out General Lyris's camera.
"Where did you get that?"
"In the glove compartment. I'll just keep the film and put the camera back." Pino hesitated and then shrugged.
"Okay."
"Stand in profile," she said. "Chin up and get your hair back. I want to see your eyes." Pino tried, but the breeze kept blowing his curly hair over his eyes. "Hold on," Anna said, digging in her purse. She came up with a white headband.
"I'm not going to wear that," Pino said.
"But I want to see your eyes in the picture." Seeing how disappointed she'd be if he didn't go along, Pino took the headband, put it on, and made a funny face to make her laugh. Then he stood in profile, lifted his chin, and smiled. She clicked the camera twice.
"Perfect. I'll always remember you like this.
Wearing a headband?
So I could see your eyes,
Anna protested. I know, he said, and hugged her. When they broke, he pointed to the far northern stretch of the lake. Up there, below the snow line, that's Mota, where Father Ray runs Casa Alpina, the place I told you about.
I remember, Anna said. Do you think he's still helping them, Father Ray?
Of course, Pino said. Nothing gets in the way of his faith. In the next moment, he thought about Platform 21. It must have shown in his face, because Anna said,
What's wrong?
He told her about what he'd seen on the platform, and how terrible he'd felt watching the red cattle cars pull away, and the tiny fingers waving. Anna sighed, rubbed his back, and said,
You can't be the hero all the time, Pino.
If you say so.
I do say so. You can't carry the world's problems on your back. You have to find some happiness in your life, and just do your best with the rest.
I'm happy when I'm with you.
She seemed conflicted, but then smiled. You know, I am too.
Tell me about your mother, Pino said. Anna stiffened. Sore scar?
One of the sorest, she said.
And they began to walk along the lakefront.
Anna told Pino her mother went crazy after her husband drowned at sea and her daughter survived. Her mother told Anna that she was responsible for her father's death and for all the miscarriages she'd had after Anna's birth.
She thought I had the evil eye, Anna said.
You? Pino said and laughed.
It's not funny, Anna said, dead sober.
My mother did horrible things to me, Pino. She made me think things about myself that just weren't true. She even had priests perform exorcisms on me to cast out the demons.
No.
Yes. When I could, I left.
Trieste?
Home and soon after Trieste, she said, and looked away toward the lake.
Where did you go?
Innsbruck. I answered an ad and met Dolly, and here I am. Isn't it strange how life is always taking you to places and to people you're supposed to see and meet?
You believe that about me? A wind came up, blew strands of her hair across her face.
I guess. Yes.
Pino wondered whether God's plan was for him to meet General Lyers. But when Anna brushed back her hair and smiled, he forgot all about that. I don't like lipstick from Paris, he said. She laughed.
Where else can we go? What other beautiful place?
You pick.
Around Trieste, I could show you many places, but here I don't know.
Pino thought, looked reluctantly at the lake, and then said, I know a place. 6. An hour later, Pino drove the staff car over railroad tracks and up a farm lane to the hill where his father and Mr. Beltramini had performed Nessun Dorma, None Shall Sleep.
Why here?
Anna asked skeptically as dark clouds were rolling in. Let's climb up there, and I'll show you. They got out and started up the hill. Pino described the trains that had left Milan every night during the summer of 1943, how they'd all come here for safety in the thickest, sweet-smelling grass, and how he and Carletto had seen Michele and Mr. Beltramini perform a minor miracle of voice and violin.
How did they do it?
Love. Pino said. They played con smania, with passion, but the passion came from love. There's no other explanation. All great things come from love, don't they?
I guess they do, Anna said, and looked away. The worst things, too.
What does that mean?
Another time, Pino. Right now, I'm too happy.
They'd reached the crest of the hill. 15 months before, the meadow had been green, lush, and innocent. Now the vegetation had faded to browns. The long grass was matted, gone to stalks, and the fruit trees in the orchard were barren. The sky darkened. It began to drizzle, and then to rain, and they had to run downhill to get to the car. When they got inside, Anna said,
I have to say, Pino, if it's my choice, here or Chernobyl, I'll take Chernobyl.
Me too, he said, as he looked up through the rain-streaked windshield toward the hilltop gathering fog. It's not as wonderful as I remembered, but then again, my friends and family were here. My father played the best violin piece of his life, and Mr. Beltramini was singing to his wife. And Tullio and Carletto, he... Overcome with emotion, Pino laid his head on his hands holding the steering wheel.
Pino, what's the matter? Anna asked, alarmed.
They've all left me, he choked.
Who left you?
Tullio, and my best friend, even my brother. They think I'm a Nazi and a traitor.
Can't you tell them you're a spy?
I shouldn't have even told you.
Oh, that's a lot to bear, she said, rubbing his shoulder. But they'll know eventually, Carletto and Mimo, when the war is over. And Tullio? The best thing is to grieve for the people you loved and lost, and then welcome and love the new people life puts in front of you.
Pino picked his head up. They gazed at each other for several long moments, before Anna put her hand in his, leaned close, and said,
I don't care about the lipstick anymore.
Part 4. The Cruelest Winter. Chapter 22. 1. Driven by northeast winds, temperatures in northern Italy dropped steadily through November 1944. British Field Marshal Alexander broadcast a plea to the ragtag Italian resistance forces, known as GAPs, to form into guerrilla armies and to attack the Germans. Instead of bombs, leaflets fluttered from the skies onto the streets of Milan, urging citizens to join the fight. The pace of resistance assaults soared. The Nazis were being harassed at almost every turn. In December, snow buried the Alps. Storm after storm squalled down out of the mountains, blanketed Milan, and fell south as far as Rome. Lyers and Pino began a frenzied series of tours of the defensive fortifications along the Gothic line in the Apennine Mountains. They found German soldiers huddling around fires in smoky cement machine gun nests, at cannon installations, and under makeshift canvas tarps. More blankets, OT officers told Lyers. More food. More heavy wool jackets and socks, too. As the bitterness of winter set in, every Nazi soldier on the heights was enduring extreme hardship. General Lyers seemed genuinely moved by their plight, and he pushed himself and Pino harder to see to their needs. Lyers commandeered blankets from a mill in Genoa, and wool socks and jackets from factories in Milan and Turin. He emptied markets in all three cities, adding to the misery of the Italians. By the middle of December, Lyers was determined to have more cattle seized, butchered, and delivered to his troops on Christmas Day, along with cases and cases of wine stolen from wineries all over Tuscany. Early on the morning of Friday, December 22, 1944, Lyers ordered Pino once again to drive to the Monza train station. The general left the Fiat with his valise and told Pino to wait. It was broad daylight. Pino couldn't follow Lyers for fear of being spotted,
When the general returned, the valise looked heavier.
"The Swiss border crossing above Lugano," Lyer said.
Pino drove, believing the valise now carried one, if not two, bars of gold, maybe more. When they reached the border, the general told Pino to wait. It was snowing hard when Lyers crossed into Switzerland and vanished into the storm. 8 bone-numbing hours later, Lyers returned and ordered Pino to drive back to Milan. 2.
"You sure he took gold to Switzerland?" Uncle Albert said.
"What else would he have done in the train yard?" Pino asked. "Bury the bodies? After 6 weeks?"
"You're right. I'm..."
"What's the matter?" Pino asked.
"The Nazi radio hunters, they are getting good at their jobs. Too good. They triangulate in on our broadcasts much faster. Baca has almost been caught twice in the past month. And you know the penalty."
"What are you going to do?"
Aunt Greta stopped cleaning dishes in the sink, turned to look at her husband, who was studying his nephew.
"Albert," she said, "I think it's unfair of you to even ask. The boy's done enough. Let someone else try."
"We've got no one else," his uncle said.
"You haven't even discussed this with Michele."
"I was going to have Pino do it."
"Do what?" Pino said, frustrated.
His uncle hesitated before saying,
"The apartment below your parents? The Nazi VIP place?" "Yes. Now, you're going to think this is a strange idea."
Aunt Greta said,
"I thought it was nuts the first time you suggested it, Albert. And now, the more I think about it, it's downright insane."
"I think I'll let Pino decide that."
Pino yawned, then said, "I'm going home to sleep in 2 minutes, whether you tell me what you want me to do or not."
"There's a Nazi shortwave radio in the apartment below your father's place," Uncle Albert said. "A cable runs out the window and up to a radio antenna mounted on the outer wall of your parents' terrace."
Pino remembered, but remained confused, still not sure where this was going.
"So," his uncle continued, "I think to myself that if the German radio hunters are looking for illegal radios broadcasting from illegal antennas, we might fool them by connecting our illegal radio to the Nazis' legal antenna. You see? We splice into their cable, attach our radio, and send out our signal over a known German antenna. When the radio hunters converge, they'll say, 'It's one of us,' and walk away."
"If they know no one is on the Nazi radio, couldn't they come up to the terrace?"
"We'll wait until they are done broadcasting, and then piggyback our signal right when they sign off."
"What would happen if the radio was found in our apartment?" Pino asked.
"Not good."
"Does Papa know what you're thinking?"
"First, I want you to tell Michele what you're really doing in German uniform."
Even though his parents had ordered him to join the organization Tot, Pino had seen how his father reacted to his swastika armband, how he looked away, his lips curled with shame. Though the chance to tell his father the truth cheered him, Pino said, "I thought the fewer people who knew, the better."
"I did say that. But if Michele knows the kind of risks you are taking for the resistance, he will accept my plan."
Pino thought about it all.
"Let's say Papa agrees. How are you going to get the radio up there? Past the lobby guards, I mean."
Uncle Albert smiled.
"That's where you come in, my boy."
3. That evening in the family apartment, Pino's father stared at him.
"You're really a spy?"
Pino nodded.
"We couldn't tell you, but now we have to."
Michele shook his head and then motioned Pino over and hugged him awkwardly.
I'm sorry, he said.
Pino swallowed his emotions and said,
I know.
Michele released his embrace and looked up at Pino with shining eyes.
You're a brave man, braver than I could ever be, and capable in ways I never would have guessed. I'm proud of you, Pino. I want you to know that, no matter what may happen to us before this war is over.
It meant the world to Pino, and he choked.
Papa.
His father put his hand on Pino's cheek when he couldn't go on. If you can get the radio past the sentries, I'll keep it here. I want to do my part.
Thank you, Papa, Pino said finally.
I'll wait until after you've gone to see Mama and Chi-Chi for Christmas. That way you can deny knowing anything about it.
Michele's face fell. Your mother will be upset.
I can't come, Papa. General Lyers needs me.
Can I tell Mimo about you if he gets in touch?
No. But he thinks I know what he thinks, and I'll just have to live with that until a better time, Pino said.
When did you last hear from him?
3 months ago. He said he was going south to Piedmont for training. I tried to stop him, but there was no getting in your brother's bullheaded way. He climbed out your window onto the ledge and got out. 6 stories up. Who would do such a thing?
Pino flashed on his younger self, using a similar escape route, and tried not to smile, as he said.
Domenico Lella, the one and only. I miss him.
Michele wiped his eyes.
God only knows what that boy's gotten himself into.
4. Late the next evening, after another long day in General Lyers's car, Pino was sitting in Dolly's kitchen eating Anna's excellent risotto and staring off into space. Anna gave him a light kick in the shin. Pino startled.
What?
You are someplace else tonight.
He sighed and then whispered,
Are you sure they're asleep?
I'm sure they're in Dolly's room.
Pino still whispered.
I didn't want to get you involved, but the more I think about it, you could be a big help with something important that could also be dangerous to the both of us.
Anna gazed at him with excitement at first, but then her expression sobered, and then showed fear.
If I say no, will you do this thing alone?
Yes. After several moments, she said,
What do I need to do?
Don't you want to know what I want you to do before you decide?
I trust you, Pino, Anna said. Just tell me what to do.
5. Even amid war, destruction, and despair, Christmas Eve is a day when hope and kindness flourish. Pino saw it early in the day as General Lyers played Weihnachtsmann, Father Christmas, down on the Gothic line, overseeing the distribution of stolen bread, beef, wine, and cheese. He saw it again that evening when he and Anna stood at the back of the Duomo, behind thousands of other Milanese, crammed into the 3 vast apses of the cathedral for a vigil mass. The Nazis had refused to lift curfew for the traditional midnight celebration. Cardinal Schuster celebrated the mass. Though Anna could barely see the cleric, Pino was tall enough to see Schuster clearly as he gave his homily, which was at once a discussion of the hardship of Jesus' birth and a rallying cry to his flock.
Let not your hearts be troubled,
the Cardinal of Milan said.
Those 6 words of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, are more powerful than any bullet, cannon, or bomb. The people who hold these 6 words true are unafraid, and they are strong. Let not your hearts be troubled. People who hold these words true will surely defeat tyrants and their armies of fear. It has been this way for 1,944 years, and I promise you, it will be this way for all time to come.
When the choir rose to sing, many in the crowd around Pino looked uplifted by Cardinal Schuster's defiant sermon. As they opened their mouths to sing along with the choir, Pino saw battered, war-weary faces taking hope, rejoicing even at a time of sparse joy in the lives of far too many.
"Did you give thanks in there?" Anna said, as they left the cathedral after Mass. She shifted a shopping bag she was carrying from one hand to the other.
"I did," Pino said. "I thanked God for making you a present to me."
"Listen to you. That's so nice."
"It's also true. You make me unafraid, Anna. And here I'm as afraid as I've ever been."
"Don't be," Pino said, putting his arm around her shoulder.
"Do what I sometimes do when I get scared. Imagine you're someone else, someone who's far braver and smarter."
As they walked past the dark, damaged hulk of La Scala, heading toward the leather shop, Anna said,
"I think I can do that. Act like someone else, I mean."
"I know you can," Pino said, and he walked all the way to Uncle Albert's, feeling invincible with Anna at his side. They knocked at the rear door off the alley. Uncle Albert opened the door to the factory sewing room, and they went in, the smell of tanned leather everywhere. When the door was locked, his uncle flipped on the light.
"Who is this?" Uncle Albert asked.
"My friend," Pino said. "Anna Marta. She's going to help me."
"I thought I said it would be done better alone. Since it's my head on the block, I'll do it my way." "Which is how?"
"I'm not saying." Uncle Albert did not look happy about it, but he also showed Pino some respect.
"How can I help? What do you need?"
3 bottles of wine. 1 opened and recorked, please."
"I'll get them," his uncle replied, and went up to the apartment.
Pino began changing from his street clothes back into his uniform. Anna set down the shopping bag and walked through the workshop, taking in the cutting tables, the sewing stations, and shelves of fine leather goods in various stages of completion.
"I love this," she said.
"What?"
"This world you live in. The smells, the beautiful craftsmanship. It's like a dream to me."
"I guess I've never seen it that way before, but yes, it's nice." Uncle Albert came back downstairs with Aunt Greta and Baca. The radio operator was carrying that tan suitcase with the straps and false bottom Pino had seen back in April. His uncle watched Anna, who was still admiring the leather goods. Pino said,
"Anna loves what you do."
He softened.
"Yes? You like these?"
"It's all so perfectly crafted," Anna said. "How do you even learn to do this?"
"You're taught," Aunt Greta said, eyeing her suspiciously.
"You learn from a master. Who are you? How do you know Pino?"
"We work with each other, sort of," Pino said. "You can trust her. I do." Aunt Greta wasn't convinced, but she said nothing. Baca handed Pino the suitcase. Up close, the radio operator looked haggard and drawn, a man who'd been on the run for too long.
"Take care of her," Baca said, nodding at the radio. "She's got a voice that carries everywhere, but she's a delicate thing."
Pino took the case, remarked on how light it was, and said, "How did you get it into San Babila without being searched?"
"Tunnels," Uncle Albert said, looking at his watch.
You need to hurry now, Pino. No need to try this after curfew.
Pino said, Anna, can you bring the shopping bag and the 2 unopened bottles? She put down a tooled leather bag she'd been admiring, grabbed what he needed, and went with him to the back of the shop. Pino opened the suitcase. They put the wine and the contents of the shopping bag inside, covering the false bottom that hid the radio components and the generator.
Okay, Pino said, after they'd strapped the case shut.
We're off.
Not without a hug from me, Aunt Greta said, and embraced him.
Merry Christmas, Pino. Go with God.
She looked at Anna.
You as well, young lady.
Merry Christmas, Signora, Anna said and smiled.
Uncle Albert held out the leather bag she'd been admiring and said,
Merry Christmas to the brave and beautiful Anna Marta.
Anna's jaw dropped, but she took it as a little girl might a treasured doll.
I've never had so wonderful a present in my whole life. I'll never let it go. Thank you. Thank you.
Our pleasure, Aunt Greta said.
Be safe, Uncle Albert said. The two of you. And Merry Christmas.
6. When the door shut, the gravity of what lay before them weighed heavily on Pino. Being caught with an American-made shortwave transmitter would be like signing a death warrant. Standing there in the alley, Pino pulled the cork and took a long draw off the bottle of excellent Chianti Uncle Albert had opened, and then handed it to Anna. Anna took a few swigs, and another longer one. She grinned madly at him, kissed him, and said,
Sometimes you just have to have faith.
Father Ray always says that, Pino said, smiling. Especially if it's the right thing to do, no matter the consequences. They exited the alley. He carried the suitcase. Anna put the wine in the open mouth of her new purse. They held hands and threw a few weaves into their steps, and giggled as if they were the only two people in the world. From down the street at the Nazi checkpoint, they heard raucous laughter.
Sounds like they've been drinking, Anna said.
Even better, Pino said, and led the way to his parents' apartment building. The closer they got, the tighter Anna gripped Pino's hand.
Relax, he said softly. We're drunk, not a care in the world.
Anna took a long swig of wine and said,
A couple minutes from now, it will either be the end of things or the beginning.
You can still back out.
No, Pino. I'm with you.
Climbing the stairs to the front door of the apartment building and pushing it open, Pino had a moment of panic and doubt, wondered if it was a mistake to bring Anna, to risk her life needlessly like this. But the second he pushed the door open, she burst into laughter, hanging on him and singing snatches of a Christmas carol. Be someone else, Pino thought. And joined her as they stumbled into the lobby. Two armed Waffen-SS sentries Pino did not recognize stood at the base of the elevator and stairway, looking at them intently.
What is this? One of them asked in Italian, while the other covered them with a machine pistol. Who are you?
I live here, 6th floor,
Pino said with a slur, holding out his papers.
Michele Lella's son, Giuseppe, loyal soldier of the organization Tot.
The German soldier took the papers, studied them. Anna hung on Pino's arm with an amused look, until the other soldier said,
Who are you?
Anna,
she said, and hiccuped.
Anna Marta.
Papers.
She blinked, went for the purse, but then rolled her head drunkenly.
Oh, no, this is a new purse, my Christmas present, and I left the papers in my other one at Dolly's. You know Dolly?
No. What is your business here?
Business?
Anna snorted.
I'm the maid.
The maid for the Lelas has already left today.
No, she said, waving a hand at them. General Lyris's maid.
That got their attention, especially when Pino said,
And I'm the general's personal driver. He gave us Christmas Eve off, and...
Pino tilted his head to his right shoulder, exposing his neck, and took a step toward them, smiling sheepishly. In a low, conspiratorial voice, he said,
My parents are away. We've got the night off. The apartment is empty. Anna and I thought we'd go up and, you know, celebrate.
The eyebrow of the first century rose appreciatively. The other one leered at Anna, who responded with a saucy smile.
Okay, Pino said.
Yeah, he said, laughing as he gave Pino his papers. Go on up. It's Christmas.
Pino took the papers, stuffed them sloppily in his pocket, and said,
I owe you.
We both do,
Anna said shyly, and hiccuped again. Pino thought they were home free when he went to pick up the leather suitcase. But when he did, the bottles inside made a distinct clinking noise.
What's in the other suitcase?
The other sentry said. Pino looked at Anna, who blushed and laughed.
His Christmas present.
Show me, he said.
No,
Anna complained.
It's supposed to be a surprise.
Open it,
the second sentry insisted. Pino looked at Anna, who blushed again and shrugged. Pino sighed, knelt, and undid the straps. Lifting the lid revealed two more bottles of Chianti, a red satin bustier with matching panties, garters, and thigh-high red stockings, a black and white French maid's outfit with garter belt, panties, and sheer black silk stockings, and a black lace bra and panties.
Surprise, Anna said softly. Merry Christmas.
7. The first soldier howled with laughter and said something fast in German that Pino did not catch. The other soldier cracked up, and so did Anna, who said something back to them in German that got them laughing even more. Pino didn't know what was going on, but he took the opportunity to remove one of the wine bottles and shut the suitcase. He held the wine out to the sentries.
And Merry Christmas to you.
Yeah? One sentry said, taking it.
Is good?
Magnifico. From a winery near Siena. The SS soldier held it up to his partner, who was still grinning, and then looked back to Pino and Anna.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you and your cleaning lady.
That sent him, his partner, and Anna into another round of laughing. As they made their way to the birdcage elevator, Pino laughed too, though he didn't know why. As the elevator began to rise, the Nazi sentries were babbling happily and opening the wine bottle. When the elevator reached the third floor and they were out of sight from below, Anna whispered,
We did it!
What did you tell them?
Something naughty.
Pino laughed, leaned over, and kissed her. She stepped over the suitcase and into his arms. They were embracing as they passed the fifth floor and the second set of Waffen-SS sentries. When Pino opened his eyes for a peek at them over Anna's shoulders, he caught a glimpse of two envious men. They got inside the apartment, closed the door, turned on a light, and put the suitcase and the radio in a closet, before falling into each other's arms on the couch.
I've never felt like this,
Anna gasped, her eyes wide-eyed and glassy.
We could have died down there.
It makes you see what matters, Pino said, covering her cheeks and face with soft kisses. It cuts everything else away.